see what you can do.
Hey, what's up, guys? Nez here, East Society Podcast Special Edition. This is a podcast that I did with some awesome guys, Danny and Ricky from the Hailing Power Hour, and Lance, and I believe Brian was with us from The Horror Returns. We talk about George A. Romero's Creepshow. We did this podcast for back last year when Houston was having all the problems with the flooding and everything. We threw this all together just for like a relief pack, a bunch of podcasts. So it was awesome to be a part of it. And if you guys didn't hear it, here it is. So enjoy. What do we call ourselves? The Cool Bros. Yeah, that's it. Party on.
Everybody out there, this is the Cool Bros podcast, which we just came together and put that name together for this special event. We are super glad to be able to be involved with this fundraiser to try to help our friends and families and our brothers and sisters in Houston during this difficult time. So it's the least we could do is to get together just a star-studded collaboration here of different podcasters from different shows and try to throw something together and just try to help raise some money. If you haven't donated or if you haven't helped somebody, stop what you're doing right now as far as listening and go find somewhere where you can donate and try to help these people out. I know for my fact of where I live, we've got several semi-trucks that are set up that people are just throwing stuff into and trying to ship out and trying to go down there and help and rebuild. So it's a great, great cause that's going on. We're glad to be a part of it. And who we are is an assemble of, like I said, different podcasts that we've all met through going to Dallas, Texas to the Texas Frightmare. And myself, I'm Rick Morgan. I come from a show called the Hailing Power Hour, and I'm one of the hosts on here. And other co-hosts we have, we got Lance Langford from The Horror Returns. What's going on, Lance?
Oh, hey, man. I appreciate you putting this thing together, man. You guys kind of got the ball rolling here, and of course, I live in the Houston area. It's just devastating, man. It's just now getting back to work tomorrow. A lot of people aren't even back to normal, and my wife had to remind me, I'm complaining about little stuff. Yeah. And this isn't the time to be complaining about little stuff. She's got a point.
Yeah, I know that there's another show that I'm a fan of called Scary Dad, and Billy Stewart is the host of that. And his sister supposedly has lost everything. The house and everything is gone. So, you know, it's devastating when you kind of start looking at things like that. So, yeah, I'm glad that we got you involved. And along with you as well from The Horror Returns, we got Mr. Brian Stitcher with us. What's happening, Brian?
Hey, pleasure to be on.
Yep. He's also on The Horror Returns. Great, great show. If you haven't checked them out, you need to check out their show. It's fantastic. And a fellow that I met through Lance at Dallas, at Texas Frightmare, is Mr. Kevin Nez from the E-Society podcast and the Mac Nez podcast. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. He's probably on something else, too. The guy's kind of a domino. He's kind of got everything going on. But what is happening, Nez?
Hey, thanks, guys, for having me be a part of this awesome event. I'm out here in California, and born and raised in Oakland, California, and I just got into the podcasting about a year and a half ago. I started with the Mac Nez podcast. That was my solo show, and then I kind of just lingered off into the E Society with my brother Theo. He couldn't be here right now. He's busy. And I just started another show with the host from Horrorcopia podcast, Jesse. We started another show, a third show that I'm a part of called the Big Guys podcast. And we've only done two episodes with that, but the response for that show has been good. I was kind of shocked. I didn't think anyone would catch on to that, but everyone likes the two little topics we've covered so far. But once again, man, I'm so glad to be here, man, and all you guys, Horror Returns, Hailing Power Hour, two awesome shows everyone needs to check out, and I'm sure you guys already know those shows are awesome. So, but I just had to say my piece because I love both of the shows.
Oh, so nice, so nice. And with me, my brother, the guy that makes Hailing happen, is Danny Bennett with me. I'm from Tennessee. He's from Tennessee as well. We're kind of best friends for over 20 years or so. Well, I consider him a best friend, or what he considers me. But what's up, Danny?
Well, that was a mouthful. it's good to be here with everybody. I'm really glad to be part of the effort to help my brothers and sisters over in Houston. We're not that far away, and actually we were talking, my family and I, about going down there and offering some support. We have a break of school coming up, and if they still need things, you know, we were considering just heading down there, putting our two hands in the mix. But it's great to be here. Thanks for including me, and thanks for all the other podcasters for jumping in and helping out in the gap, because I imagine we'll raise some money and help some people.
Yep. So this is going to be a lot of fun. I don't know what other podcast you folks are listening to at the time, but this is going to be kind of a little bit horror-based, but almost kind of nostalgic in the same form. I think the movie we're going to talk about hits a lot of different buttons. It's not just a horror movie. It's one of those roller coaster rides you kind of grew up with. So I'm excited to get to talk about it, and just the fact of we lost the great George Romero not too long ago. It's a great opportunity to talk about Creepshow. I don't know if we want to go ahead and dive straight into that, or if there's some other things we want to talk about before we get there. What do you guys think?
Right before we get into this, I noticed you had a picture that you met George Romero. Where was that at?
I've met George three different times. I met him once in Chicago and twice at Dallas at Texas Frightmare.
All right, cool. I met him once. I met him at San Diego Comic-Con, and I was just starstruck. I mean, almost to the point of where I was just like shaking as I was waiting my turn to talk to him.
Yep.
But he was an amazing guy. I just kissed his ass, and I just, I couldn't believe it. And he saw that too, because he went, "Whoa, brother, calm down!" And I kept telling him, "I said, man, I love you, man. Thank you so much for what you have done." And this is another one, Creepshow. I mean, when I first heard of this, it was the comic that was out. I used to sit in a bookstore right around the corner from my house, and just read books. And this was one I thought the cover was cool, so I picked it up and just started flipping through it, and didn't realize that a movie was coming shortly after that. And once I saw the movie, I was like, oh my God. I knew it was Stephen King, but I had no idea George Romero was involved with this until his name flashed across the screen. Then I was really hyped, but I love this movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Are you sure you weren't shaken with fear because George Romero is like 7.5 feet tall?
He's a huge guy. Yeah.
Yeah. I met him here at there's a tattoo and horror festival here in Nashville, and I met him there. And him and Tony Todd, man, I mean, they could be tag team wrestlers, both humongous people. Yep. And then I met George again when he pulled up to the urinal next to me at Texas Frightmare. I didn't talk to him because he was peeing, but, you know, it was still one of those moments. It's like, hey, George Romero's peeing right next to me. That's pretty cool.
Right?
I think somebody else tried to talk to him, and I was like, that's bad form, man. I mean, come on.
The first year that I went to Texas Frightmare, it was all a Living Dead celebration. They had most people from the original cast and that stuff. And I took I took my buddy David Foster with me, who's Romero is everything to this guy. And we went all out, man. We got to go to the theater and watch the 35mm print of Night of the Living Dead. And sitting beside us was Dee Wallace and Malcolm McDowell, Ken Foray. George was a few rows back. So, I mean, you're sitting here with all these people. Of course, I have to admit, I looked over at Dee Wallace, and I was like, I love you. And she just kind of went, okay. So we went to do that, and then there was an after party for that. And we walked outside, and we weren't for sure where to go, because it was from the theater to wherever this other building is. We don't know anything about Dallas, but Ken Foray standing outside, and we say, hey, man, you know where this party thing is? He said, yeah, man, he's just follow me. So we're following Ken Foray to this party, you know, and my buddy David's just freaking out, you know. Well, we're at this after party thing, and we're eating pizza with some of the original members of Night of the Living Dead and all this stuff. Savini's over in the corner, and so everything's going on. But then David disappears. He says, I want to go outside and smoke. So, no, actually, I went with him. I said, okay, let's go out. And we go stand out there, and George is standing out there smoking a cigarette and drinking a little bit, and he just, you know, David's walking through the door and he just freezes. He won't even step out the door because there's the man, right? And I'm like, dude, just go on out there, you know? So we stand there for a little bit, and I said, all right, I'm going to go back in. And he said, I'm going to stay out here for a while. So I go back in, I'm sitting there, and like 10 minutes later, he comes running in, and he's got something in his hand. He said, here, hide this, put it somewhere. I'm like, okay, and he hands it to me, and it's a broken highball glass. I'm like, what the heck has he done? And he takes back off, and he comes back later. He's like, man, have you still got that? I'm like, yeah. I said, well, are you afraid we're going to get thrown out or something because you broke a glass? He said, no, man. He said, George was standing out there drinking. He went to set the glass on top of the trash can, and it fell and broke. And he said, oh, I'm done. I've had enough. And he walks off, and he said, I grabbed a glass. He said, I've got Romero's DNA. Oh, that was a long story for such a short punt there, but
that was great, man. That was great.
But
he should have went back and took a cigarette butt.
That's what I'm saying. So.
There you go.
But I think he actually built like a box with some LED lights and stuff in it, and it just sits there and glows.
No way. Come
so,
on now.
Diehard Romero fan, man. So, but yeah, George is super nice. I knew that his health was bad last year at Texas, because he was signing, but he wasn't personalizing. He was only just writing his name, and he said it was getting harder for him to write. So I knew then that, you know, people were saying it, and he's, you know, just his health is going down. So it's an absolute shame. But, man, the movies he left us with, you know, they can remake them all they want. They're not going to have the same impact of what the originals did.
That's also true.
This one was I thought this particular film was a little bit I'm glad you guys picked this one, because it's a bit of a departure from what he normally does. It's right. A lot more comedy oriented, and I kept wondering as I was watching it, I kept thinking, well, did different directors do this? Because that's what they do, of course, with all the anthology stuff now. But for one director to put all this together the way he did was really phenomenal.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so as well. Just the fact of, like you said, usually people just take the parts and they just combine it in an afterthought, but to lay out this massive of an idea and to set up an anthology that I'm just going to go ahead and say it is still my favorite anthology of any anthology movies that are put out there. This one, to me, is the staple. When you describe a horror anthology, this is the one I'm going to grab. And it's so well done, and it goes together so well. Just the fact of it moving from the comic book stuff into the actual film and all that stuff is just brilliant, man. It's so well done.
That's what I loved about this. I mean, like me reading the comic before I saw the movie, I liked how it kept that comic book feel. It didn't just kind of linger off into just a regular horror movie. It kept it. I mean, even the little slight comedy puns that they were throwing in it, it was just like in the comic book. So I assume he must have just read it over and over and then just pieced it together in his mind, what his vision of what he wanted to be on the screen. And I agree with you, Rick, man. This is probably my favorite one, too, as well. I love this one. The second one was awesome. The third one I didn't care for. But this one, out of all the horror anthologies that we've had this far, this is my favorite one of all time.
Cool. Brian, what you think, man?
This is definitely a classic, and as you were saying earlier, you know, this is a lot of nostalgia for me, and just going through this cast list, there's a lot of people that, you know, you really forget was in this until you rewatch it. You know, you got Tom Atkins, yep. Tom Savini, Ed Harris, you know, the list goes on. It's Stephen King himself.
Yeah.
You know.
At his cocaine-addled best, right?
Yeah.
And that's a great point, because I think it gave this more credibility than it would have. I mean, the fact that it's got Tim Danza and Leslie Nielsen in it is just sure. Like, what? George Romero's doing a movie with who? And I think that kind of made people go, okay, maybe this is a legit, you know, beyond just a low-grade horror event going on here. So, yeah, man, it is surprising when you watch back and you see these people in it. It's like, man, this is solid. You got, you know, really good actors. It's put together well. It's a classic. So, came out in 82. I was 12 years old when this came out, and this is the perfect movie. It even says it on the cover, the most fun you'll have ever being scared. That's exactly what it was, because at 12 years old, you're still at that point of, okay, I want you to scare me, but don't scare me too much. You know, you want that roller coaster ride. And that's exactly what this movie is. Even though, when we'll talk about it later on, but Fluffy in the crate scared the crap out of me. So you guys,
yeah, no CGI there, that's for sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. So it was shot for $8 million and it did over $21 million in the box office, so it did really well. And like you said, it the way that it goes is when you start trying to make sequels off these things, they pump less money into it. Even though I still enjoy the second one, just like we said earlier, it's just really hard to beat this one. It's hard to beat this one with current anthologies, really. So and the fun of it, like we said, of it tying into the comic and all that stuff. So I say we just kind of jump into this one. Y'all, what do you think?
You bet. All
right, so you've got your opening, right? You've got the wraparound with Tom Atkins, like we were saying, who plays the dad that you just absolutely hate. And the fact that Stephen King's son that's in the bed that's, you know, reading the comic, Joe.
Really?
Yeah, that's Joe King. Yeah.
Is that Joe Hill?
Joe, yeah. Joe King.
I'll be damned.
I always think about Stephen King naming his kid Joe King. I'm joking.
Just before we jump into like a scene by scene, I think it might be good to find out what either is everyone's favorite part of the anthology or is the one that affected them the most when they first saw it.
That
stuck in their memory the most, because you know that kind of gives everybody where we're coming from. Then we can start going scene by scene, but we get bogged down when we go scene by scene. So
gotcha.
And so I'll start off. I'll say that when I was a kid, the one that stuck with me the most, I think the best one is the crate, but as a kid, the one that stuck with me the most was the Leslie Nielsen.
Something that tied you over.
Something that tied you over.
Yep.
Yeah, it was the Ted Danson, the head in the sand thing. I mean, that messed me up.
Yep.
Just something about that, you know, it kind of has all those trappings of like the vanishing, you know, where like you have to get in the hole. You know, well, something will happen to her if you don't get in the hole. It's that whole psychological play that was much scarier than monsters. It was just, you know, you have to trust this guy who obviously has a plan for you, but what are you going to do? He might hurt somebody you love. And the one that scared me the most was they're creeping up on you. So the swarm of cockroaches at the end. I mean, I don't think I could even finish watching that. I was so scared. But, it was 1982, so I was 8.
Yeah.
And I probably saw it a couple of years later, but yeah, those are the two, like the Tide one. And now I can watch it. I love Leslie Nielsen, but I won't get into that. We can just go on to whoever's affected them the most or was their favorite one when they first saw it. What about you, Lance?
You know what? I couldn't agree more, man. You took the words right out of my mouth. That Something That Tied You Over was far, far and away my favorite. And I think I just enjoyed seeing Leslie Nielsen in such a different role from what he normally plays. He was so darn sadistic. And the thing about it is, every time you see this guy, it's just a straight up comedy. And this was, he was kind of gleefully laughing and sort of had that comedic side to him, but it was for all the wrong reasons. And I actually found myself wanting more. By the time this one was over, I wanted to know what made him that way. I wanted to know if maybe this was some kind of a revenge thing. I'm thinking that he had all those VHS tapes that he probably does this regularly to a lot of different people out there on that private beach that he owns.
He seemed to have the method down, didn't he?
He seemed to have the method down. I just really wanted to know more. So this one left me wanting a lot more. The main thing I remember about the creeping up on you one is E.G. Marshall. You guys remember the old radio drama he used to do many, many years ago?
Not me.
I don't, but his voice is extraordinarily familiar. He does a lot of voice work.
Well, Danny and I know him from being the president in Superman Part 2.
In Superman 2.
Oh, there you go.
God help us. That's Zod.
Yeah, this was Something That Tied You Over, far and away my favorite.
I guess I'll go next. I guess They're Creeping on You is probably the one that still gets me to this day. Just the amount of roaches that are in this.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, you got, I mean, granted, he's a terrible person, but just being this kind of hermit like germaphobe that can't leave his penthouse, and you just got all these roaches just constantly showing up no matter what you do. And, you know, it, that one still gets me to this day, still creeps me out.
They said that was the most expensive thing, was the getting the roaches for this whole movie.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, just the volume, because you couldn't just CGI things like that you can now. I mean, I'm sure they did things like they put a black backdrop behind 100 of them to make it look like they were on top of each other or something, but it was all practical, and you had to have roach wranglers. And roach wranglers are probably not cheap.
Yeah. But, and the fact that they had
a six-figure salary, huh?
They had to go ship them in, too. I mean, they were actually going to another country to where they could find these caves where all these were at. And I've seen, you know, the documentaries about it, and Savini would say, hey, we would drop these cockroaches in that set, and he said, and they would just disappear. He said it was amazing that you could just dump a pile of them in there, and they would just be gone within seconds.
Then they had a lawsuit from the set next door.
So, yeah, it's if you haven't seen the documentary Just Desserts, it's fantastic.
Haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're... That's a true story about getting a lawsuit from the next door set?
No, no, I just figured that they probably
Ah, okay. He had me going, man.
But there is a documentary called Just Desserts, though, that is fantastic, and it breaks all these down, you know, step by step through the process. It's, you know, heavy on the effects, you know, talking to Savini about how he pulled a lot of the stuff off, and so it's a great documentary. If you love this movie, I'd highly recommend checking it out. So that's a good one. What do you say, Kevin? Right,
yeah. My favorite is The Crate. I mean, I love that story and just everything about it. But, yeah, I have to go with Something to Tide You Over. That one was, to me, was the scariest. Other than I just love the whole zombie aspect of it. But being trapped in a hole. I mean, even Ted Danson and what's her face from Dawn of the Dead? Galen Ross. She was Becky Vickers. Holding your breath. I mean, that scene when the final scene, or not the final scene, but the final scene when Ted Danson, when they show him completely underwater, if you sit there and time that, I mean, it was actually a long time for just one shot with him holding his breath under the water. And I was just like, ooh, I couldn't imagine that. I think I would have rather just have taken the bullet and tried to fight Leslie Nielsen, because I was like, oh my god. I mean, as when I was 82, so I was 11 when this came out, and sitting there watching it with my brothers, and like, oh my god. I mean, all of us said, why doesn't he just rush him? But I don't know. But yeah, that story always just kind of got with me. I mean, I love to swim and everything, but just the fear of drowning and being stuck under to the head in sand, wet sand. I don't know if any of you listeners ever just stuck your feet in the sand and buried them, and then it's hard just to pull your feet out. So I'm pretty sure he just could not move at all under all that. And I'm not sure how they did actual effect. Maybe it was just his head and his body was free. But even still, man, just thinking about that and watching this, what was visually on the screen, I was like, oh, man, I think that was the scariest thing out of everything on this. And it still bothers me. I just finished watching it again this morning.
Yeah.
And I just still had that eerie feeling that I had when I very first saw this movie. And yeah, Something to Tide You Over was probably the scariest to me.
Yep.
So, Rick?
Well, and I, to tie on to that, I think the reason that that one stays with you so much is because it's something you can relate to. Just like you went through and described, Kevin, you know, the fact of everybody as either gotten their feet stuck in mud or sand or something to where you couldn't get out. Imagine being buried up to your head and there's nothing you can do about it. That's a scary factor. Even a small kid can relate to that. So that is a humanistic fear. The rest of these things are based off of more monsters and things. This is something that somebody would be cruel enough to bury you up to your head and do this, because at the end of the day, people are the real monsters. And I really think that was what makes this so disturbing. Just like what Danny was saying earlier is, you know, Leslie Nielsen is this guy that's so cool and collective, but he has this all planned out of how he's going to pull this off. That's what's scary. And the fact that he has no remorse, the fact that he goes back out there and says, oh yeah, the tide must have took him. That's what happened. The tide took him. You know, just to, you know, rationalize what happened. And I think the fact of, we grew up, you know, I remember my dad saying that when Airplane came out and Leslie Nielsen was on there, it was weird to see him playing comedy, because he was always known as playing either the villain or a drama, So it was so out of character. And I was like, for my generation to see him in this is totally out of character for us, because we've seen him always be the goofball. And for him to play this character and be so menacing, and you know, he plays it really well. And I don't know. I think it's a standout performance. You know, like you said earlier, Galen Ross is Romero royalty from Dawn of the Dead. Ted Danson, it just gives it so much more credibility being these folks are in it. But at the end of the day, the scariest thing to me is still that thing in the crate, man. When Fluffy comes out, it's when that guy when that guy goes in there with that flashlight that takes like 28D batteries. It's longer than his leg, right? And he goes in there and shines the light, and when that thing grabs him and it goes across to his neck, it grabs him and, you know, bites across his neck, that still looks incredible. And then he like just plants his face against the wall and just scrapes down the side of his face. That's horrifying, man. That's a bad little monster. And
I'll never forget the janitor's like flashing his light in there and saying, "Looks like emeralds," and just reaching his arm in there. It's
oh, absolutely.
That sequence, like, I still think of it sometimes. That looks like emeralds, and reaching in there, it's like, oh, that's a terrible idea.
Well, we know that's a terrible idea. He might not have known that at the time. He was kind of blinded by seeing the emeralds there, huh?
Well, you know, he was chasing a quarter for the Coke machine, and then, you know, he can't distinguish between, you know, Yeti eyes and emeralds, and this guy is not equipped to live.
Darwin Award winner, huh?
Sorry, Rick. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I totally changed my plan. The scariest thing in this whole movie is when Ed Harris is trying to dance.
Oh! Oh, you're telling me you did not like his dance moves?
And who was singing ABBA? Don't Let Go. Like, that's the only thing that comes to my mind every time I think of that scene.
Hey, did you guys notice, though, in They're Creeping Up on You, the music that he's playing, it's the same music that's in Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Wow, all right.
So. Well, all the Evil Dead music came from library archives, right? It was sure. it was all free stuff that had passed its statute of limitations, so it didn't have to be bought.
Yeah.
It was royalty free.
Well, George was the king of that, man. I mean, everything he did, you know, besides getting, you know, Argento got Goblin to do the stuff for Dawn of the Dead, but the rest of the music is all, you know, free, you know, uncommercialized music. So the gonk and all that stuff that he used, pulled it out of the library. So, but yeah, it was pretty interesting that the same music is in both of those. So
that was a fun little romp, you know. And with that out of the way, we can talk about it. I mean, all the anthology pieces in this, not one of them is really a weak link. I mean, you might say that, you know, the Stephen King, the Lonesome Deaths of Jordy Verrell, or, you know, that's kind right. of a weak link, but it was comedy relief.
I don't know.
And although,
man,
there's comedy in all of them, it's
the end of that one's so disturbing, though, man. It really is. I mean, when you think about it, it's like, holy crap, man. I mean, I'm 11 years or 12 years old watching this, and this dude is blowing his own head off with a shotgun. It's just like, yeah, that's pretty.
But
heavy.
It's a bush blowing its head off. I mean, there's nothing in there that's intended to really. Maybe it was different for you, and you know, it was kind of sad. But I think the whole thing was still kind of goofy.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. It just ended on such a such a sad note. It's like, holy smokes, man.
Yeah, that's a pretty lonesome death, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Did you guys notice that at the end there was a road sign that pointed to Castle Rock?
Yes.
As a kid, I never caught the importance of that. And then I watched it, I was like, oh, look at that, it's Castle Rock. It was like watching the president of Superman 2 getting killed by a bunch of cockroaches.
Right. What a way to go.
The wraparound, man. I think, you know, the bookend pieces for this are fantastic because, again, Tom Atkins. I mean, who doesn't love Tom Atkins? Got to meet him a few years ago as well. Super cool guy. But he sure is an ass in this one. You know? And the thing that always stuck out to me when I was watching this, because of the age again, but, you know, the kid had a really cool Rodan toy hanging up on his ceiling.
And they show it like four times.
Yeah, well, and to tempt me, because I kept asking my folks for that and I never got it. And there it is in this movie over and over. So I was like, oh, man.
I had that Rodan toy.
You suck.
Yeah.
the thing that I noticed in that scene, in the beginning scene, the wraparound, I mean, when Tom Atkins is really laying into his son, telling him, he goes, because he even says to his wife, you want him reading this horror crap? And then you look around his room and he's got monsters, right. He's got a Dracula poster on the wall, sure. And I'm like, okay, he's just interested in what he likes, and you're getting mad about this comic book, but I don't know. I mean, but I did it, man. Tom Atkins is awesome. I just recently met him a couple months ago at the Sinister Creature Con, and my brother and I, Mike, we went up and talked to him about this, because we both told Tom that's how our dad was towards us, of just being real strict and didn't like what we were watching. But my dad don't care now. But at that time, when we were at a young age, we kind of got that feeling from him. And he was like, oh, right on. Thank you. Because even Tom said that, he was like, yeah, man, a lot of people that I talk to, they always come back to that scene. He goes, yes, it was only a few minutes in this little small movie. He goes, but everyone says that's how they felt that. Of how their dads were towards them. And I was like, whoa, I said, that was cool. He goes, yeah, it's something that I hear every convention that I go to. But yeah, man, like you said, he was really cool. He was kind of off to the side. He was like at the very end of the autograph area and nobody was over there. And we stood there and talked to him forever. He was a really cool guy.
Yep. Yeah, very.
Wow. That's always awesome.
Very approachable. And I ran into him. He was looking for the bathroom. He's like, and this is after that after party thing I was talking about earlier. He was at the same convention. He was like, hey, where's the bathroom around in this joint? I was like, I think it's right down there. I said, he said, thanks, buddy. I said, well, I said, my name's Rick. And I shook his hand. He said, I'm Tommy. I said, yes, sir, I know who you are. And he was like, I'll holler at you later on, Ricky Bobby.
He had to go.
Yeah, from that point on, every time I saw him, he would say, hey, Ricky Bobby, what's going on? So, yeah, it was kind of cool.
You know, and just talking about it now, this is a good thing to lead into so we can start off with the movie. I derailed this early on. I try and do that. But what about the handprint on the kid's face? Like, you know, because he gets smacked, right?
Sure.
And I was looking at that going, you know, is that makeup? Or did they really just, maybe they just pressed a hand against his face like before the scenes? But I mean, like, it was really like little three finger marks where that kid got smacked. And it was just one more thing to set you in that kid's shoes. You know, it was just one more little like reminding you that he just got smacked. He didn't just get berated. He got, you know, physically abused.
Yep.
I was reading some stuff that, as a joke, Stephen King, he took his son to McDonald's during a break and he left him in that makeup. And he said the lady in the drive-thru saw him and just got so worried that she called the cops. Oh. And then I don't know what happened after that, but it was just a quick little thing that I read. But yeah, he got called out on it because that lady in the drive-thru thought that Stephen King was beating his son.
Oh, wow. And the rest is history.
You imagine that now?
Right.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
That picture would be like, she would have taken a cell phone picture and it would have been all over already.
Yep.
The damage control from that one.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing I relate with this too, I mean, because I know he's talking about the horror stuff, but this is, I would relive this because of being a diehard Kiss fan at the great age of 8, you know?
Hell yeah.
And the parents would come in and pick up your records and go, you know what this stands for? It's Knights in Satan's Service.
Service.
And so, you know, I really related to that as a kid because it's like, no, man, it's just rock and roll, you know? And you know, they want to try to pinpoint these things, the reason that kids grow up to become maniacs or whatever, but nah, you either already have it in you, or maybe it's just bad parenting that makes it happen. But so that's very relatable to all of us. Again, having that kid in there and that being the focal point really drives it home, especially if you're, you know, young when this came out. And I've always, that like you said, talking to Tom about it, that wraparound just has always stood out to me. I don't know that I would do like at the end of it where I ordered a voodoo doll and start stabbing him in the neck or anything like that, but it makes it pretty interesting. So you kind of jump out of that. then you it goes into the comic book part where you get the creature that's outside and it floats off, and then it turns into the comic book pages, which you kind of see later on in some other movies that kind of pull from it. Swamp Thing and all these other movies try to do these dividers and have the bubbles come up that kind of look like the comic book. So you can kind of see where people start kind of pulling from this movie and using it. But Father's Day, which I remember as a kid, I mean, the whole talking part, I was like, yeah, blah, 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 blah. I just wanted to see the monster, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you go back and watch it, it's pretty interesting. Bashing, you know, the dude in the head with the big ashtray and all that stuff. You got, again, Ed Harris's dance is worth the price of admission. You just got to see that. So they talk about that on that documentary as well, about, you know, there really wasn't any music playing. They were just dancing to nothing and just going for it. So that's a lot of fun. Another veteran of Romero is John Amplis, who's playing the actual, he's the corpse that crawls out of the ground. So even if you don't see him, you get, you know, John Amplis, who is Martin, you know, from the movie Martin. And he's always been in a lot of Romero stuff. So I like how he always pulls people in that he's always used and just keeping them working, man. That head on the platter, can't beat it. That's legendary.
Right.
I finally got my cake.
I definitely think it was definitely the slowest of the segments, which is just probably a good reason why it was at the very beginning to kind of ease you into it a little bit, and then you get that shocking scene at the very end to kind of set you up for what's to come.
Right. Yeah, it's a great opener for what's down the road, for sure.
I was probably like you, and in the as a kid, I probably looked right past all the talking. But it was my favorite part, obviously, of rewatching it. You know, the dialogue is campy, but it's so well delivered. And it's kind of like Clue. You know, it's kind of like the whole manor house in the middle of nowhere. And there's the storm brewing outside. And there's the history of the old murder. And I love the way it's put together. It's so campy, but it's so good.
Yeah, the lady driving the Rolls Royce, she's got this, the little cigarette hanging out of her mouth. She's just gunning this Rolls Royce. I mean, it's great, man. It really is. It's a great setup. So
and the whole history being told, and then in the flashbacks, and then in the comic book panels.
Yeah,
you know, where's my cake? And she's like, you know, it's really fun. It could almost be a silent movie. Yep. You know, the dialogue's great, but it could almost be a silent movie the way it's put together in frames.
Yep.
And I enjoyed it a lot more as an adult watching it.
And you have to admit, you know, the fact of him sitting there and just slamming that cane on those armrests and just saying that.
Yeah.
That's intense, man.
What I liked about it, they do this effect in every story, was at the very end when her dad comes out and he's got the head, the cake head, and the two characters are like, they show him screaming.
Yeah.
And there's always this, when there was a single shot of them, they always had that, like, psychedelics imagery lighting in the behind them.
Right.
And I've seen this movie a million times, and I noticed it the very first time, but then I just realized that, geez, they did that behind everybody in this when something tragic happened.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the things that I loved about it. I liked that imagery that they always had in the background.
Yeah. And it's straight out of the comics, you know, that they were talking about growing up reading the EC comic stuff. So, you know, they literally just took those comics and just threw them on the screen. So, yeah, it's so effective. And it only works in this kind of situation. You know, if you tried to do that in every horror movie, it'd be like, yeah, you know, when Michael Myers is killing somebody, we don't need that behind him, you know.
So rainbow colors, bright colors behind him.
It was the comic book. It was the comic book feel. It was all the panels it lended something to it so that it could be like a stage play.
Right.
So that you suspended disbelief already because you were just reading the comic book and it was coming to life.
Yep. And I love, just like you're saying, you get past that point of with the steel frames and stuff, but then you get the shot where it turns back into the comic and then it goes right into the next story. You know?
Sure.
And I just love how they used the comic to go from story to story. And that goes straight into, like we said earlier, the lonesome death of Jordy Verrill. You know, could you imagine anybody else playing this part but Stephen King? He's just perfect for this part.
Yeah, no way. I really enjoyed this segment quite a bit. I know You know, I know you guys were saying it's different. It's comic relief and all that. But, yeah, you got to realize that Stephen King never took himself too seriously. I mean, of course, you guys remember him at the ATM machine in Maximum Overdrive. Right. And he was never afraid to poke fun of himself, and I always loved that about him.
Yeah. I think they were trying to find somebody else, and George Romero kept saying, man, you'd be perfect for this. You'd be perfect. And had to really convince him to take the role on. And in the middle of all that, too, all of his flashbacks he has or the scenes of him going to the doctor or whoever the guy is that's supposed to be buying the meteor from him. That guy's creepy, man. Floating around in the chair with the big butcher knife. And I mean, it's so out there that it just makes it wonderful. I mean, it just really, you know, again, I always look at this with kids' eyes. That's so far-fetched and put out there that, you know, his imagination, you know, Jordy Verrill's imagination is that of a kid's, because that's exactly how a kid would see a doctor. Some guy's going to come in and stick you with something and not be a nice guy. I mean, everybody's scared of those things. So, yeah, I love it, man. I think he's perfect for the role. Oh, Jordy, you nunkhead. I mean, it's just got some great lines in it, man.
Did all this happen in Maine? Because usually that's where Stephen King's stories are.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Well, I mean, because it said Boston,
right? Castle Rock. Boston, yeah. Castle Rock, 5 miles away. Boston was like 30-something miles away. And there was another town. Was it Portland or something like that?
It was Portland.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, but that's his wheelhouse. So
sure.
What I liked about this one was, other than the comic relief of Stephen King, Brian, you can probably appreciate this. Well, let me ask you a question, Brian. Who were the wrestlers in the wrestling match she was watching?
You know what? I can't remember. You got to remind me on that one.
Vince McMahon was calling the match, and they said the World Wrestling Federation before they changed it to what it is now, WWE. Mm-hmm,
right.
But it was, at the time, it was the champion, Bob Backlund, and one of the Samoans. They called him. They did say Samoan number one. I knew it was Bob Backlund. And I knew it was a Samoan as well, but I still couldn't tell which one it was. But I thought that I noticed that off when I first saw this, because I'm a huge wrestling fan, and I was happy that and from what I understand, that Stephen King is as well. I said that I think that's one of the reasons why they threw that in. But I thought that was cool. But just this whole, I think this was like the saddest one. I mean, yep. He was, I'm going to be rich. And then you just slowly just see his downfall after he gets the meteor stuff on him. I was going to say it, but I wasn't sure.
Go ahead, say it.
Right.
It was meteor shit. I love that part. That's probably my favorite line in the whole movie. But,
oh, yeah.
And how it just slowly just started to eat him up and everything. And then the flashbacks that he was getting with his father.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty creepy and everything. But yeah, I mean, and as well, even at the very end when he finally just, he couldn't do it and just blows his head off. I mean, when I saw this in the theater the first time, I could kindly understand what he was saying, because they really did something to his voice. And yeah. I was just like, oh my God. And then, like, he even said that, please God, and then blew his brain out, blew his brains out. I was like, oh man. And I was always wondering after when the police would show up. I mean, did they even know he was there, or did they just see all this green stuff and just say, oh, hell with it, and leave?
Yeah. Good question.
Yeah, and also with that ending, you just get the added, the weather report about the incoming rain?
Right.
So,
mm-hmm. Oh boy.
How much of this was going to spread?
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, little bit deeper segment than we first gave it credit for, it sounds like.
The whole scenes of him, you know, his dad talking to him through the mirror and all that stuff, I thought that was always just horrifying as well. I mean, tempting him, you know, the whole thing about getting into the tub and all that stuff. Yeah, it's just messed up. You come out of that one and you go straight into the one we've been talking about the most, which is Something to Tide mm-hmm. You Over. Again, when you watch Just Desserts, they explain, you know, how they buried them and how they got the water to do what they needed to do. So I can't recommend that one enough. You guys need to check that out for sure. But Brian, kick us off on this one, man.
Yeah, this one, you got Leslie Nielsen that finds out that his wife is cheating with Ted Danson, and basically lures him out to, he explains to him that, you know, I got something to show you, I'm gonna lead you to her, and then he leads him to his beach property and basically gets him to get in this hole and get buried. And I think, did they talk about it in that the making of it, the DVD you were talking about, Just Desserts, they did the effect of the tank, because I read that it was a suit that he was wearing that had basically an aquarium that he stuck his head in.
They kind of even show, you know, a little bit of behind that. So yeah, it's again, it answers all those questions we've always kind of wondered about. How did they pull that off? You know, the fact that he sets up a TV screen for him to watch her drowned at the same time, you know, where she's, you know, downstream a bit, and the fact that he can see her and that's happening to her at that time, and he's trapped and can't do a thing about it. That's just messed up, man.
Yeah, and then he drops that line about how he just never doesn't let anything go, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The thing that, about this whole story, I was wondering, did he have it hooked up to a generator, or did he just use really long extension cords?
That's what I was wondering.
Same he used thing a really here. Long extension cord. They show him he's driving out to where he is in that Jeep, and he's got a cord spooling behind the Jeep, and he cuts it off and sets up the TV there. I noticed it this morning. I probably wouldn't have noticed it as a kid, but like, I was like, what is that? Is that cord running behind the Jeep? And it was. You know, and I almost thought, but before I started watching this, I almost thought it was Robert Hayes and not Ted Danson.
Huh.
Because in my mind, I was getting it mixed up with Cat's Eye.
Yeah.
The ledge. It's the same setup. You know, it's like the guy's having an affair with his wife, and he's got an ordeal that he has to go through.
Right.
And I was like, that's Robert Hayes, isn't it? Or is it Ted Danson? And it was Ted Danson. And I was like, where's Robert Hayes? And I had to think about it. But it's the same kind of setup. And I don't know why I had felt the need to throw that in there.
No,
but
that's
he had cords pulling off his Jeep.
Well, again, you're showing that all these other movies have kind of taken these ideas and turned them into something different. You know, this one started all that, man. There would be no Cat's Eye if Creepshow didn't do so well.
Yeah, true enough.
You got to remember that's Stephen King as well. So
it's Stephen King, yeah.
Right.
I mean, and I have to say, the reason I think we all kind of picked this one as one that stuck with us, and we talked about it, is the psychology of it.
Sure.
You know, it's because the monsters in this one are not really, they're like vengeful spirits. They aren't really the danger, because by the time it comes around and they've come back for him, he's the bad guy. You kind of want him to get his comeuppance.
Sure.
But it's the two innocent, well, I mean, they're not innocent. They were adulterous, but it's these two people that he's dragged out. I mean, they're not worth, it's not a killing offense. You know, they weren't innocent of something, but they betrayed someone. It doesn't mean they need to go get, you know, drowned.
Right.
But it's the whole, well, you know, I've got someone, you know, somewhere, and you don't know what I'm doing, but you just have to trust me, even though you don't know me and you know I'm mad at you, and you have to get in this hole.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Kevin said, you know, rush the guy, you know, rush him and take the bullet. But at that point, you're like, well, he might let me out of the hole. Maybe he just wants me to not attack him while he shows me what's happening, or he might hurt her. There are all these unknowns that you just really have to trust this guy. And Leslie Nielsen does no attempt to make him trust him either. He's not like, hey, you have to trust me, I'm your friend. None of that. He's like, do you want what I have? Do you want her to be okay? We'll get in the hole. He doesn't lead him to believe that he's trying to mislead him. And that's the scary part, is because, you know, you're just trusting this person and putting your life in their hands. And again, I have to go to The Vanishing. You know, it's like, get in the box. I'm going to bury you in the ground. Yeah. You know, there's nothing more frightening than that. Yeah. There's nothing more frightening than that.
Who did not jump, though, whenever Leslie Nielsen's in the house and they start coming at him and he shuts the door and he turns around and they're right there?
And there they are.
Oh, that's so great, man. That's great.
I love the effects that they made, the underwater, putting seaweed on them and just making them look all waterlogged. I mean, I thought that was amazing effects. And was that actually Ted Danson and Galen Ross under all the makeup?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, man. I mean,
I was going to say the effects of them talking was pretty cool too, because it also sounded like they was underwater.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, bubbly sounding.
And when they shot them in the head, and the bluish black blood come out of them, it was like, wow, they just went.
Oh
out
yeah.
Was Savini behind the makeup and everything?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is all Savini.
All right, cool. That's what I thought.
Yeah, it could have been. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the old Rod Serling show, Night Gallery.
Sure,
but this could easily be something that was on Night Gallery back in the day, and I love Night Gallery. So yeah, this was just a standout one, and it's. Credit to a lot of different things, man. Some great performances in this one. So again, this one kind of gives it credibility as far as the people that's in it. Even though we're stepping into the next one, which is The Crate, which has Hal Holbrook, Adrian Barbeau, George Romero's wife at the time, Christy Romero's in it. I mean, so again, and that guy that looks like the doctor that's in Reanimator, even though it's not him. I never can think of his name, but it's who he reminds me of. And, you know, I remember it took so long for me to appreciate the story around The Crate. Because, again, as a kid, you just want to see, you know, the blood and guts parts.
Get to the action.
Yeah, but Adrian Barbeau, man, in this one. Yeah, you want Hal Holbrook to just shoot her in the head, you know.
Yeah, you'd be among that group clapping, huh?
Right.
I love that. They all just look down and, and they very politely applaud, you know.
The guy.
Well done. Well done.
Great shot.
Yeah.
And again, that's another masterful, you know, screenwriting tool where, you know, they give you multiple action scenes where she gets killed before the actual scene where she gets killed. You know, all of his fantasies are played out to kind of placate the audience. So that you just have to wait the whole time for the thing, because it is one of the longer sequences in the movie too.
Yeah, definitely the most fleshed out of everything in the movie.
You know, he could have just broke up with her though. Just saying.
Well, I guess. But you know, I mean, if you were married to Adrian Barbeau, it might be a little harder to just break up with her. I don't know. She might have been doing some things off screen that made it kind of worthwhile a little bit. You know,
that's possible. Well,
there's also the thought that, I mean, you know, as meek as he was and as strong as she was, she'd put him through the ringer, you know, if it was
no doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Well, yeah, should have took more than half.
You're right. She'd take her half and his half too, right?
I love Adrian Barbeau, no matter what she's been in, but this is the first movie that I was sitting there watching it going, I hate this gal. I mean, when I watched it much later when I was older, a buddy of mine, he goes, I hate this part. I was like, what are you talking about? Because he goes, it reminds me of my ex-wife.
Oh, no.
So he always gets really happy when he shot her in the head and when she finally gets it in the end. But he was just like, oh, my God. He goes, I hate her. I can't look at her. That's all I see is, I won't say his wife's name, but he goes, that's all I see.
Wow.
Right. But this one was awesome. And another thing, Fritz Weaver played, he was a Dexter Stanley. Was he trying to get it on with those little with the younger college students? Because it seemed like he was, was flirting around with them.
Oh shit! Well, if you were a college professor, you probably would be too.
Because the way he was standing there holding a drink and looking at them and just flirting around them, and they were just giggling, and then time around, I was like, whoa, I didn't even notice that before.
Very possible. It's amazing the older you get and you look at these things, you start seeing stuff that you were like, no, wait a minute. So, yeah, that's a good call, man. I didn't pick up on that either, but I don't know. I thought maybe he was interested in the guy with the really long flashlight.
There you go.
Well, and also, you know, when he brings Wilma in, you know, for your mentioning of the guy trying to get it on with the younger girl students, you know, that's part of his story, you know, is that he had cornered a girl down in there. So, you know, that seed is planted. You know, maybe it's something that he knew about his friend that he just, you know, used as a, you know, as a part of the ploy to give it more credibility. I really love those letters You know, the letter he wrote to Wilma and like the little monologues that Hal Holbrook says, because I mean, they had so much flavor to it. His voice is so steady and they're so well written.
Right.
I mean, I said that, you know, the tides stuck with me and the roaches scared me, but I can't say that the crate isn't the best put together of all of the stories.
Yep. That's a good one. And just the fact that when he finally gets Billy down there and he's like banging her against the crate and you're like, it's not going to work. He went through all this trouble and that thing's going to be like, yeah, I'm not hungry anymore. I've just ate three people.
And now that you say that about the notes and everything, it was too well planned. It seems like that Henry was his name. It seemed like he had this plan in his head for years, and he finally got to do it because it was so perfect on how.
Coming.
Yeah, and I loved it because he had maybe an hour or two to throw this all together, and it was a perfect plan.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He had been fantasizing about the murder for years, so he probably continued on to figure out how he could get away with it.
Yeah.
That was the only way he was going to get out of the nightmare that was his marriage, right?
Yeah, it was the only good way to where if she died, he didn't do it. So he was free and clear.
And I don't know about you guys because of the way it ended, but I always wished when they made part two, and that's what drew me to part two, I thought, well, maybe they'll do a continuation of what happened here, you know, because they just dump it off. And I thought, well, maybe this will continue on, you know. I don't know if any of y'all ever thought anything about that, because they basically just chain it back up, dump it off in the lake, right?
Yeah, what's next?
Right.
Yeah, and where did it go?
Yeah, so I thought maybe in part two, maybe it's the return of the crate, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, if that creature made it since, what, 1836 or whenever they originally closed the crate, I mean, without any food or water or whatever in there, then a little bit of underwater action isn't going to bother it at all, you know?
Right. So, yeah, I, instead of the crate part two, we get thanks for the ride, lady, you know, but which I'm not knocking. I enjoyed it too, but you know,
kind of sounds like you're knocking it, man.
That's a different podcast we'll cover on.
what I liked about the crate the most is the suspense.
Yeah.
Of like when the intern guy, Charlie Gleason, Robert Harper is the guy we were talking about. When Dexter is explaining to him, showing him what happens, he sees the blood all over the floor, and he sees the trail marks that goes back under the staircase. Just the build up for him trying to see what's going on, while he's trying to get that shoe and shining the flashlight in, and is slowly creeping in there. Just the suspense, because you knew it was coming. But it was just the build up to it, and then when it finally came, it paid off. And like you had said, the effects of him getting bit in the throat and slashed in the face. I mean, I just that was amazing. I loved it. I mean, it was just I loved it. And I've noticed all during the horror scenes that the light would change all spooky and crazy and red or blue, and it was just awesome. I loved how they did that with this in this story.
Yeah, it kind of gets that, you get that Argento kind of color flash going on when the surreal stuff is happening like that. It just adds to it so much. When you end up really hating somebody that's in the movie, it's just a credit to their acting abilities. And so Fluffy's always going to be a favorite of mine just because I'm scared to death of it. And I got my picture made a while back with Greg Nicotero, who had Fluffy right there on his table. And we kind of did a picture. Oh. So that was kind of cool, you know. But yeah, I still looked at that thing and I was like, yeah, I'm still scared of that thing.
Oh, real quick, what I liked in the comic books in this story, when Billy gets hers, the Fluffy actually just pretty much bites her whole face. And I liked that they incorporated that into this. I mean, it wasn't as gruesome as it was in the comics, but I mean, it was good enough. I was glad that Fluffy bit her right in the face, so I thought that was cool.
Nice.
So yeah, coming out of that, we get into the final one of the bunch, which is They're Creeping Up on You. You've heard us talk a little bit, elaborated on it a little bit while ago, but Yeah, this is E.G. Marshall, who is basically an acting legend. George Romero said he was even shocked that he agreed to come and do the movie, because apparently he's got a lot of high clout as far as, you know, people really respect him in the acting world. And again, it's that Superman 2 performance. That's what did it.
That's what did it. Pushed him over the top.
But he nails this, man. I mean, you're talking about hating somebody. You can't stand this guy, and you can't wait for something to happen to this guy. And the setup is fantastic for it. I remember just being amazed by this because of how white everything was in the room, how sterile. And, you know, this is what happens when we raise our kids too much with hand sanitizer. They become this
That's
kind
right.
of person.
So we're developing a generation of these people.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and that phobia is eventually what kills him off. So the fact that he thinks the way he does about people and things, and then the phobia that's created because of that is eventually what kills him, it's a pretty strong statement as far as what's going on with this. So this one to me has more meaning behind it than the other ones do. This one's actually trying to make a social statement of don't be like this, you know. Don't be the crotchety old white guy that hates everybody and everything and manipulates everything and threatens everybody's jobs and it's pretty deep.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize we knew he was just this uppity rich guy that was better than everyone, but I didn't notice the N-word he threw in this scene, or when he was on the phone talking to someone. I was like, how did I not catch that before?
Yeah.
But it goes back to you thinking you hate him. You already hate him right from the get-go, and
right.
and you want something bad to happen to him. But, I mean, E.G. Marshall, man, he was amazing in this. I mean, and like you said, I mean, or like they said, You were shocked to see him in this, but yeah, as far as Superman 2, my favorite one out of all of them. But yeah, he was awesome as the president. But this scene, I mean, what made me love this part of the final story of this one, and even to this day, when I go and pour my cereal, all I can think about is there going to be roaches in there once I dump it in my bowl? Because that scene of him dumping his cereal and being roaches all in it, I was like, ugh, that stuck with me forever.
Yeah, when he's grinding up the stuff in that processor and he's eating it and he's digging through it, and you're like, ugh.
Oh man, yeah, I couldn't make it all the way through this one. Actually, I had to turn this one off about halfway through. It was really getting to me.
Yep.
And that, as a kid, that was it. Like I finally made myself get through it, but it stuck out of me as the one at the end that I wouldn't watch, because you know, he finally gets himself in that safe room
right.
away from all the roaches, and he's like, you can't get in here. You can't get in here. And then, you know, that pallet behind him, that upholstered bench or whatever, starts moving.
Oh, jeez.
And it's just and you know what's under there. I mean, again, like I think it was Kevin that said, you know, about suspense in the crate. You know, suspense is used pretty well in a few of these. You know, where it's just when you think something's going to happen, when the build has finally reached its crescendo, it doesn't happen. And then a few minutes later, it happens in some other way. And for a set of simple stories like this, it really does stick with you, because it's like, I really thought it was going to happen this way, and then it happened that way, you know. And that one, you know, with that, I'll always remember that moving thing behind him, you know, because, again, that was his last bastion of safety away from these things, and they got in there too, because
right.
the roaches, you know, how are you gonna stop them?
Mm-hmm. Man, and let's face it, the effect of the body laying there and then busting out of his chest and coming out of his mouth is nightmarish. I would put that up there with some of the effects, some of the greatest effects in horror movies ever. That thing is just it makes you get the heebie-jeebies when you're just sitting there watching it, man. It's that well done.
What I liked about that effect is, going back to the comics again, seeing that for the first time in the comics, so I'm sitting there in the bookstore reading this, and then I think out of everything in the movie, I think that's what I wanted to see the most.
Sure.
I knew it was coming, and I wanted to see how they were going to do it. And this is 11-year-old Nez sitting in the theater watching this, and I was blown away. I mean, to me, this movie is a special effects, a practical effect masterpiece of what they did in this, and I loved it. And it, another thing that made me think about it is after all the roaches just came pouring out of his chest and out of his mouth and everywhere, when the camera shot pulls back and you see just the flood of roaches in there, I'm like, damn, they must have just filled his whole body to have that much in there.
Yeah, it's so much that it's beyond what would actually fit into a body. So it's just, I don't know, man. It's great. It's great. It really is. And
the old clown car concept, huh?
Right.
and it almost makes you forget how terrible of a person he is, just because it's you're just in shock of what's going on, and like you said, the effect of them pouring out of his body.
Right.
And it was done so well.
Yep. Yeah. It which kind of becomes a trend later on, Rob Zombie, of making you feel compassion for the bad guys. You know,
sure.
It's getting to where that's kind of the trend now, and this obviously helped, you know, move that forward as well, because there's no reason for you to care about this guy at all. And at the end of it, you're just like, there's no way you didn't walk out of the theater and still have the after seeing that, you know. Like we said, after that, you get the end of the wraparound at the end where the little boy, you get Savini and another guy that's at the trash pickup guys. They're on the back of the trash truck, and they pick up the comic book and they're flipping through it because the dad's throwing it away in the garbage, and they're looking at all the different advertisements and stuff in there, and then they see one for a voodoo doll, and the piece is cut out of it where you can order.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And then it shows the dad sitting there eating breakfast, and the mom's ironing a shirt, and she notices there's a patch out of his shirt where somebody's taking a piece of material, and the kid is taking the material and put it around the doll, and he starts stabbing the thing in the neck, and Tom Atkins is, you know, oh, you know, through the neck, and that's the end, man. It's pretty awesome, man. I mean, the wraparound to me is just as strong as the stuff you see, and it's just a well-made, put-together movie. And you could tell that they loved this collaboration of getting together and doing this and putting these stories together. So, yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it.
What I liked about the little advertisements for the voodoo doll, or the one you tired of getting sand getting kicked in your face.
Oh, yeah.
Those little ads they would show in between, little segments in between each of the stories. I love that. But what I love, I keep going back to the comic because that was the first thing I had seen with this. I mean, I love it. I mean, they just reprinted it, so it's out there now.
Cool.
Because it was out of print for a while, and it was really expensive. I wasn't going to pay for it. But yeah, if any of you guys have not read the comic and you do want to, it's out there. Pick it up. It's well worth whatever. I think it's like $20 or something. But it's well worth it. It's awesome artwork. I wish I knew who the artists were. I didn't pay attention to all that when I was a kid. But I loved it. It was awesome. But what I loved in this, in the movie, is the comic that he was reading had a different cover. And then at the end of the movie, it's the kid poking the voodoo doll. Did they say that was the creep or the creeper?
Yeah.
Because they did in the second one.
Yeah, I think that's the name, but they never say it in the first movie. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, it's going back to that old EC comic of they had a kind of a Crypt Keeper type character that you know,
sure,
did these things. So,
got to have your host,
the storyteller, if you will. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, but this movie is a masterpiece, man. Yep. I love it. If you guys haven't seen it, go stop everything and go watch it.
Absolutely agree. So, and I thought coming out of that, I mean, anybody else want to say anything about Creepshow before we go any further?
No, I think Kevin did a good job of surmising that it's an excellent movie, and everybody should check it out.
Yeah, Nez is good about that, man.
Yeah, I'll give it 1,238 cockroaches.
Whoa. No, I think that's what the producers gave it too, and it was the most expensive part. I'll give it one creature hanging on a crate under a staircase for 146 years.
I'll give it one Adrian Barbeau tied up in Swamp Thing. With their arms up in the air. Which is a good thing.
I'll give it a million severed head birthday cakes.
And I will give it one Ted Danson. I give it one Ted Danson sitting underwater drowning.
Should have happened years ago. No!
Oh, nobody saw that episode of Cheers?
I missed that one.
You lunkhead!
I give it one Ed Harris dance.
And that says a lot.
Man, Ed Harris was still on something too, man. He was not there. He was still in Knight Rider.
Exactly. Ah. Well, which is what led into them creating creep shows, because if you watch Knight Rider again,
Knight Riders.
Yeah.
I did it wrong.
Of course, yeah. Ed Harris is the King Arthur of the bunch, but Stephen King is there and his family are there watching this event going on. They're jousting on motorcycles and stuff. So they became friends through all that somehow. I think they invited them on the set, and then they decided to put the story together for Creepshow. So it's, yeah, if it weren't for Knight Riders.
Wait, did it go like where they're like, so first you're jousting on motorcycles, and then you're friends.
Is that how it went? Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's exactly how it went.
Thank you, John Lovett.
That's right.
Speaking of Knight Riders, Marty Skiff, I think it's Skiff, that's how you say his last name, but the second garbage man that was Tom Savini, he was right. Also in Knight Riders, and he was one of the bikers in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, oh, nice. No kidding.
Yeah, again, Romero likes to reuse people and just keep them busy. So, yeah, man, that was something I always liked about watching the Romero films. Which, speaking of, I know we've just talked about Creepshow, but we kind of have to break this into two different things. This is something quick I just kind of wanted to do while we're here. Because I know we're all Romero fans, but I want to know of the original zombie trilogy, the Dead trilogy, which one of your guys' favorites?
Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead.
Well, Dawn of the Dead.
So, what about you, Danny? You got one?
I'm going to have to say Night. Cool. I mean, I'm not just to be different. I really like Dawn. But Night of the Living Dead, just it was the first one. It synopsizes the whole thing.
Yeah,
I'll stop talking.
It's the original. It's where it all came from. Well, to me, mm-hmm. I'm one of those cellar dwellers, man. I love Day the best.
Really?
Yeah, Day's my favorite of the trilogy.
You've said that before.
Yeah. There's something about it. I don't know if it's just how dark and bleak the whole story is. The effects are just amazing, and I don't know, man, there's something about Joe Pilato's character, just the meanness of the people in this one. You know, Dawn is got a grander scope because you got the bikers coming in and trying to take over the mall and stuff. I love Dawn too, don't get me wrong, but there's just something about Day that just hits me, man. I think the fact of you're in the situation and you're trying to make the best of it after things have calmed down a little bit. And, mm-hmm. you know, so you got that military angle of trying to, you know, stay in charge of what's happening, and they're losing their grip quickly. And then you got the whole experimentation of trying to get, you know, coexist with them, which is just asinine.
Well, I do like that part at the end where Patrick Swayze, like, tears that dude's throat out. That's probably my favorite part.
And then he dances with him or what?
Yeah. Man.
Well, I've
had the time of my life.
All
right. So it doesn't surprise me. And Dawn is a classic. It's fantastic. But so outside of that, what is your other favorite Romero film? Or is there a favorite of him that goes beyond that?
You know, his stuff is so surprising. I'm trying to think of his body of work. And of course, you think about all the zombie movies first.
Right.
Because that's where he made his stellar debut. I mean, you know, I don't know if that was his first movie, to be honest. I think it was.
Yep.
But if it wasn't, it was definitely the one that was kind of his breakout.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then he's got some movies that you just would be like, that's George Romero? And it's almost Creepshow is almost one of them, because, you know, you kind of don't realize the scope of his talent.
Well, you got.
And then you watch a movie and you're like, oh, this is George Romero.
Yeah. People don't think Monkey Shines or you know, The Dark Half or
Dark Half was a masterpiece,
right?
That was it Timothy Hutton that was in that one?
Yep.
Yeah,
Oh man, what a great performance! Right. That's probably mine now that you're talking about it. I was gonna say Monkey Shines, but just for the silliness of it. But yeah, Dark Half is a really good chilling horror movie.
Yep, it's a well made film for sure.
I love Season of the Witch. I mean, wow. It is what it is.
Yeah, never seen it.
I'm gonna have to go with one of his last movies, Diary of the Dead. I mean, I love all the movies, and Dawn of the Dead being my favorite. But and even Dark Half. Dark Half was good. Monkey Shines was awesome. Martin, I love that movie.
Yeah, I love Martin.
But Diary of the Dead, he jumped on to the found footage thing.
Yep.
And I did not like it the very first time I had seen it. I had seen an advanced screening of it, and I left the theater like, what the hell was that? But once it came out on DVD, I watched it over and over again. And I just watched it recently. I mean, after he had passed, I just kind of went through my whole Dead series of movies. And that is one of them that, for what it is, it's really simple movie. But I loved what he did with it. I mean, now that I do, like I said, the first time I saw it, I didn't really care for it. But it's just something about that movie that I love. I mean, I love found footage movies. And it is kind of getting played out, but I think he did an awesome job with that one. It's really simple. It's right to the point, and I love it.
I think he was kind of returning to what made the original so great, and I enjoyed that one as well. I saw it in the theater when it came out, and I didn't care for the last one, though. Which one was it?
Yeah, neither did Kevin.
Survival?
Survival, yeah. No, but I thought Diary was his last great attempt at trying to, you know, capture the glory of the old stuff. I thought it was pretty solid, man.
I'm not familiar with his whole body of work, to be honest, but of the ones I've seen, you know, and I've certainly been impressed with them, I still have to go back to Night. And
sure.
I have a soft spot for Night of the Living Dead, maybe because I saw it early on, and it was one of the first movies that really kind of scared me in a not at the moment, but much later kind of way.
Right.
After I watched it, you know, I kind of started to process what that meant. And I think there's a whole lot going on behind that whole film. And there's a whole lot of, obviously, I love the fact that there's social commentary in it. And I hate the fact that that commentary has kind of gotten lost in the larger narrative.
Right.
And there's so much zombie stuff going on now that, you know, you don't have the, you don't see the nuance that he put in it. You don't see that at Dawn of the Dead, it's about a group of people escaping reality in a shopping mall, because a shopping mall is kind of an invented reality, and how that ultimately brings about their demise. You know, they figure they're okay because they're away from the zombies, but it's other people you got to worry about, and that's always the narrative, is that it's the other people you got to worry about, not
right.
the overwhelming ghouls that are coming after you. And that's kind of what Night, you know, it's kind of, again, like I said about the birthday cake one, you know, it's kind of the whole manor in the estate is kind of a stage play. You have a few people with problems with each other, and they're playing it out with a larger looming enemy. It stuck with me, you know. Yeah. It's a very concise concept. And Nez, I'll have to make sure to check out Diary of the Dead, because I haven't seen it. And you know, I wasn't avoiding it. I remember when it came out, it played at the Belcourt Twin over here, where I saw Cloverfield, actually. And I thought, I should go check that out. But, you know, just going to see it, it just got lost, and I haven't. But you know, since you gave it since it's your favorite Romero movie, I might have to just go check it out on that alone.
It's a different take on what he does. This is supposed to be the beginning of it all.
Right.
But set in the modern times, it was just because what I had seen. We saw four movies of awesomeness and of just the living dead eating everybody, and this one it didn't have as much as he's had in his previous movies. But I just loved how he shot the whole thing and the whole concept of it all. And I was just like, Why is he doing found footage? Yes, he jumped on that bandwagon, but I thought he did it really good. I mean, it's an amazing movie, man. But you just have to sit through it. It's a really slow burn, but you just got to sit through it and enjoy it for what it was. It took me a few viewings to really enjoy it, because I did, like I said, the first time I saw it, I walked out of the theater like, what was that? But I'm such a huge Romero fan. I had to have it. I'm a completist. I had to have it in my library. So, and then I just watched it over and over and over, and now I love it.
One that grows on me every time I see it is Land of the Dead, because you get the evolution of the zombie, that they're now able to communicate with each other, and some of them actually use weapons in this. And then you also got still the rich is the rich and the poor is the poor,
right?
And it's kind of crazy how you got the rich people staying in this high rise building and everybody else is just out on the streets fending for themselves, and it's pretty crazy.
Yep. And again, it's just the tear down of civilization, and your rich people are still going to try to hold on to what they have. And he's making that commentary of, you know, what happens if there is a fallout, how does these things work out? The zombies is just a background for all these stories that he's telling. It's amazing. I think in the first movie, that wasn't the intention, but I think as he went along, the zombies were just, you know, the situation. Danny and I have talked about this a lot. Cube, movie called Cube, it came out. Same scenario, except instead of it being zombies, you're in an interchanging room that changes every so often. You're with a group of people that's dealing with chaos. It's the interaction of those people that's what keeps you interested. It's the reason Walking Dead's going so long. It's about those people involved. So, I'm going to go with the crazies, man. I love the crazies. it's low budget. It's early Romero. Another big statement movie. That priest running outside and pouring gasoline on himself and setting himself on fire mortified me, man. It was just, I mean, the fact that dad at the beginning, you know, kills his family and then sets the house on fire, and then they got him in a cop car later on while the house is burning and he's yelling for his family to get out.
Oh no.
You know.
Wow.
That movie is heavy, man. And I that one just stays with me. It's so strong. And the fact that at the end the government's like, yep, we can't let this go any further. Let's just nuke the place. So I thought the remake was pretty decent, but it still doesn't hit me like the original does. So that's my favorite Romero film of all of them. That one really stands out. I do have a soft spot for Martin as well. Just a modernized vampire tale. But outside of the zombie flicks, it's got to be the crazies for me, for sure. So
yeah, I love that one. That one had a real the dread of something happening and everyone just going nuts. I mean, that was pretty much what he did in all the movies. But when the guys in the white suits, what were they? I saw this movie a long time.
Just like the military. I mean, it's just the military coming in and trying to quarantine the town. But you got people that are, you can't tell the difference between the people that are nuts and the people that are normal, because just some are just acting totally different and setting people on fire and things like that. So, yeah. You know, you got the people you're following through the story are getting knocked off as well. So it's just, it's a zombie flick without zombies. I mean, that, you know. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. Good way to put it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I love the original. Original one was amazing. I mean, I did like the remake. It was what it was.
Right.
But this one, I mean, I loved it. Every minute of it. And it's just the style of Romero. I mean, he has that in pretty much all of his movies.
Right.
And speaking of remakes, really quick. Which out of the original Dead trilogy that they did the three remakes, which ones did you like?
No question, best? Night of the Living Dead was amazing.
Hmm. Again, I'll say Dawn again. I like that the Zack Snyder reinterpretation pretty good. Well. You know, fast zombies in this one. It's a little scary.
Yeah, I'm Dawn of the Dead. I mean, I love that one. Zack Snyder's was amazing, and that's probably my favorite out of all. And I love Savini's Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah,
I loved how it just stuck with the original story with the little changes.
Tony Todd, man.
Yeah, it was awesome. But Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, out of those three, did Day of the Dead?
No,
it was what it was.
Terrible.
But Dawn of the Dead was my favorite out of those three.
What you think, Brad?
I'm also going to go with Savini's A Night of the Living Dead.
That's for the man right fact, there. Yeah.
They gave the character Barbara a little bit more to do in this movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I liked her character arc in the movie, where she started and where she ended off.
You seen any of the remakes, Danny?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm very familiar with the Tom Savini remake of Night, and I've seen the Zack Snyder remake of Dawn a few times. And I'm a fan of Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
I think just like I think Zack Snyder has a really good eye. You know, his imagery is always really crisp. But you know, of them, I have to stick with Night. I guess I'm sounding like a broken record now, but the remake of Night of the Living Dead is really good, and I think it kept all the important factors that made me like the first one. You know, sometimes remakes will lose track of that, and although it's different, I think it still, you know, it kept the spirit that always made me like Night of the Living Dead when I walked away from it.
And you got Tom Towles as the bad guy, which, you know, I remember when we finally got to meet him, and I didn't know if I wanted to shake his hand or slap him because I hated him in Henry. Every movie I see him in, I hate him. You know, he's such a bad guy. So, he just plays that part so well. So, yeah, all great ones. You know, I like so much Romero stuff, and it's sad we've lost him. And while we're recording this, we have lost Tobe Hooper as well, and we talked about maybe sneaking a little Tobe Hooper stuff in there, but we want to kind of keep this short and sweet. With that being said, Lance, you guys go ahead and tell everybody what your show is, where they can find you, all that good stuff.
Well, you know, Brian is our lovingly nicknamed the Barry White of Alaska, and he's kind of our social media dude. So I'll let him tell everybody where to go.
Yeah, you can go on, type in The Horror Returns for the Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Our email address is thehorrorreturns@gmail.com, and we also have a Facebook group. Everybody's welcome to join the Facebook group. We love to interact with our listeners.
Fantastic. All right, Kevin, your turn, man. Tell us where we can find all your shows at, buddy.
I'm also on Podbean and iTunes. Just look up SkaterNez Podcast Network. Skater spelt different. It's SK, the number 8ER. Second word, Nez, NEZ, and then just Podcast Network. All three of my shows are on there. East Society, MacNez Podcast, and Big Guys Podcast. They're all on there. And I also do a segment, The Native Side with Nez, on for the Horrorcopia podcast. I usually close out the show with Blind Frankenstein, and I believe you can find that on iTunes as well. And go to Facebook, look up MacNez Podcast or East Society, like the page, that's it. Old Twitter at MacNez Pod, I believe. I don't know. I go on it every now and then, but. Instagram, MacNez, and that's pretty much where you can find me.
Awesome. And Danny and myself have the Hell Mean Power Hour that we do. It's not all horror stuff, which I think we all kind of, you know, dabbled in different things, but right. But we just have a love for movies that we grew up with, very nostalgic. It's not just about Flash Gordon. People kind of get confused about that. It's just the namesake of the show, and it gives us a nice background, but... Danny, you want to tell them where they can find us at, man?
What's a podcast?
It's where people talk like we're doing right now, you know?
Oh, right. Like the recording stuff.
Right.
Got it. So it's the Hail Ming Power Hour. We have a page on SoundCloud. We have, are we still on Stitcher? No?
No. We owe anything that's tied into Legion, we're on, so.
Yeah, it's iTunes, Google Play. We have a Facebook page, which is probably where most of our traffic comes through. So Hail Ming Power Hour is pretty it's pretty unique. So if you type that into a search engine, you'll probably find something that'll lead you on a little merry chase to find us. And we'd love to have you. So go on board.
Yep, iTunes, all that stuff. Also social media. We're also on Instagram and Twitter as well. And we're just a bunch of goofballs, man. We have a good time. And we are... so excited about being able to get together and do something like this with these guys, because if it wasn't for us starting a goofy little show, we wouldn't have met these guys. And so it's just great to get together with people that enjoy the same types of things and just get together and do something good. So guys, it has been fantastic getting together and chatting with you guys, and I hope we can do it again.
Oh, we will. Thanks for the invite. Really appreciate it.
Brian, great talking to you, buddy.
Yes, it was definitely a pleasure. Big fan of the show. Also big fan of your other show, Short Bus Cinema.
Oh, yeah, Short Bus. Yeah. And
lest we forget the short bus.
Yeah,
we're all headed there after recording, folks.
And I've got something up my sleeve coming out here in maybe another 2 or 3 weeks too. So y'all be on the lookout for that too.
And you've been in touch with him. Johnny Krug isn't near the flood zone or anything, is he?
He's got some pretty heavy rains that kind of messed up his ceiling in his house and stuff, and he's dealing with a lot of mold and stuff like that right now. So, Kevin, man, enjoyed getting to actually talk to you a bit. I know we just met briefly kind of in Texas, and we've been talking a lot online about stuff, so it's kind of cool to get together with you as well and talk some Romero, man.
Yeah, man, thank you for inviting me on to this. I've been on the Horror Returns a few times and just meeting them, just chatting with Brian off and on. And Brian's also been on my show. But hanging out with Lance and Phil and the beautiful wives down in Texas. And, yeah, and just meeting you really briefly. I didn't know who you were. I just actually got into your show through Lance. We were listening to someone. We were driving around. And then when I saw you, I didn't know who you were until I heard your voice. You have that, that voice that you can't forget. And then I was standing there and listening to you. What I remember is your awesome Jaws shirt, and I was like, "Oh my God!" And I mean, you were just a little bit that I was there around you. You were hilarious. And this, I went back and I started listening to your show, and I love it, Danny. You as well, man. You got an awesome show. I just can't wait to hear more. And I just finished your last episode, and same thing with the Horror Returns with their Death Note episode.
Yep.
I'm leaning more towards the anime guys than the movie.
Okay, but, most people are.
Yeah, I mean, everybody. I mean, all you guys' shows are amazing. I love being a part of them when I can, and I can't, but my heart does go out to everybody down there in the Houston area. It's a tragedy. I can't imagine. I live up on a hill, so I don't get no flood, but I do know that there's a volcano close to us, so hopefully that never erupts. But yeah, my heart, my cousin, she lives down in the Houston area, and her house is, or her apartment, yeah, it's her apartment. She lives on a lower floor, and she showed videos and everything, and I was just, oh my God, I can't believe that stuff like this happens. I mean, but it happens, and right. all we can do is do what we can to help out. That's send right. money, send food, or go down there and help if you're close. And like I said, my heart goes out to everyone that's affected by this.
Right. Well, with that being said, I guess we need to sign off. People, keep your heads up. There's going to be brighter days ahead. And just take care of yourselves, and bless you all. We'll talk to y'all later.
Texas.